There was no sound now but the hissing of the powerful air conditioning.
"Sit down in the chair," Wilkes said over the intercom.
"Where is he?"
"He moves with your eyes, so he appears totally still. The eye doesn't see anything that's totally still."
"Yeah, like a rock or a mountain."
"No," Wilkes explained. "When you look at anything at all, you're in motion, so you see it. Since Adam is constantly making micro-movements to match your eye's own natural flickering, he doesn't register on the optic nerve at all."
"What in hell is this about?"
"Tell you what, if you want to see him make a very sudden movement, as you do that, concentrate on the corners of your eyes, not your central vision. You'll see him."
She sat, took a deep breath, tried to concentrate on her peripheral vision, and leaped to her feet. Not a foot away there was a shadow, then it was gone again. "He's right here, he's right on top of me." Then he started wailing again, and she could feel him whizzing around the room. More and more he was racing past her face at the distance of what felt like about an inch. Dad had gotten scratched. She sat frozen, terrified.
"Stay with it, you're doing marvelously."
She could see Wilkes nodding and smiling at her. "This is one hell of a sucker play," she yelled. "False damn pretenses." She got to her feet. Adam whizzed past so close she was forced to sit back down. She jumped up again. Same thing happened.
"He likes you, Lauren," Wilkes said.
It felt a lot like getting a bat in her hair or something. How had Dad ever stood this? It was just way, way too weird. "So what are we doing with an alien?" she screeched. "How in the world did we capture an alien?"
"We got two of them in a crash in New Mexico. They may have been given to us, we're not sure.
Bzzz, whoosh. Get away."
"He wants to touch you. Let him touch you."
She began waving her arms around her head. "No way, I'll bleed out."
"Remember, that was an accident. He's in an agony of grief. That's why he's like this. Now you settle down, young woman, and follow your orders."
Pictures of Dad kept flashing through her mind like photographs. With them came emotions of grief and the most acute regret. It was clear that they entered from the outside, although she could not say how she knew that. It was sort of like breathing a kind of emotional smoke.
"Shh,"
she whispered.
"Now, baby."
She looked toward the control room. The buzzing stopped again. Something brushed her cheek. "I think he just touched me."
"I know you're sorry," she whispered.
"I know." She looked again toward the figures in the control room.
"What am I supposed to do now?"
No response. So she comforted him. She went through her mind seeking for the words of some song from childhood, some sort of comforting song. Dad had not been a big singer. Mom had her Elvis. But this did not appear to be your basic Elvis moment. Then a sort of hallucinatory flash took place. In it, the light in the room was deep red, and there was a man at the table sitting across from Adam. On the table, a bright green light like a laser that hopped up and down in the air. The man was her dad. It was so real, it was so good to see him again that the tears were immediate. And then she heard inside her head, "Ooh." And she knew that Adam had realized who she was.
"Yeah," she said. "Yeah. He was my dad. Oh. Oh.
Oh, yeah," she managed through her own tears. "I miss him, too. I miss him bad." She saw next a glowingly beautiful woman, her face surrounded by a halo of golden light. It was, she knew, herself as Adam saw her. Empath. One who empathizes. Turned out it was in the blood. No training needed. Genetic thing, she supposed. Maybe their ancestors had been psychics or witches or something. Dad's grandfather had come from Ireland. That was about all she knew of their bloodline. In the control room, Colonel Wilkes and Specialist Martin exchanged looks.
"He's got her wrapped around his little finger," Wilkes said.
"For sure, sir."
"He knows how to handle him, the little bastard. That is one smart piece of work in there."
They said no more. Lauren Glass had been captured. She would not escape, never. Not until she followed her father and his predecessor, both of whom Adam had killed with a scratch. Part 2. The Three Thieves. They stole little Bridget for 7 years long. When she came down again, her friends were all gone. William Allingham, The Fairies.
3. Dan came into the kitchen while Caitlin was washing spinach and nuzzled her neck. She moved her head back, enjoying him. In their case, not even 13 years of marriage had been enough of a honeymoon, and she was very far from being used to this guy of hers. They had met here at Bell, 2 days after he arrived. Bizarrely, it turned out that they'd both grown up in Madison, Wisconsin, just a few blocks from each other. He'd been crossing the campus in that aimless way he had, looking here and there, smiling even though there was no reason to smile. He was a strikingly handsome man, the last person you'd pick for a professor, let alone a specialist in physiological psychology. But that's what he was, and he'd just snared a provisional professorship when they met. Now Bell had reached a point of no return with him. This was, at last, his tenure year, and in a few days his career here and their pleasantly settled life would either continue or it would end. "What's Connor up to?" she asked. "Is he downstairs?" "He's in the living room." "Too bad. He'd hear us if we went upstairs." "Mmm," he continued nuzzling. Their son was more than a genius. A well-constructed, handsome, towhead, gentle of eye, and so smart that he was a de facto freak. His IQ of 277 was, as far as anybody could determine, the highest presently on record. Dan came up from nuzzling and said, "He's in a funk." "Symptoms of said funk?" "Staring miserably at the TV, pretending not to stare miserably at the TV."
"He's 11.
11 has stuff." She arched her back, drew his head over her shoulder, and kissed the side of his lips. "He's watching 2001, which meant that it was a serious funk and he needed Mom.
"Why didn't you say that in the first place?"
"In the first place, I wanted some love." She went into the family room, stood for a moment looking at the back of her son's head. On the ridiculously huge TV Dan had unveiled at Christmas, the apes were howling at the monolith. She sat down beside him.
"Can I interest you in..."
She glanced at her watch, picked up the TV guide. "A Mork and Mindy rerun? The McLaughlin Report?" "Invasion of my space, Mom." "Point taken, backing off." But she didn't do that. She knew to stay right where she was. "And just because I'm watching 2001 does not mean that I'm sad." What could she say to the misery in that voice? "Connor, a genius does not an actor make. Mother, could you consider dropping that label? You say that all the time and it does not help." "That you're not a good actor?" "Okay, let's do this. Would you care to come out on the deck with me?" "On the deck? It's 26 degrees. But he'd already gotten to his feet and slid open the door. He gestured to her and she saw the anger in it. She went out with him. The air was sharp with smoke, the western sky deep orange beyond the black skeletons of the winter trees. One would have thought that a winter silence would prevail, but instead she heard the shrill voices of preteen boys. When she looked down toward the Warner's house, she saw streaks of light racing around in the backyard. "You're not invited." He went back into the house, sat down, and jammed the button on the remote. The bones sailed into the sky, the Blue Danube started. Pauly and Connor had been friends effectively from birth. Connor's birth, that is. Pauly was a year and a half older.
"Connor, what happened?"
"Nothing."
"Something happened."
"Mom, I've asked for space."
"Honey, look. You've got one place you can go, here. Two people who are 100% on your team, me and Dad. And I want to know why you aren't at that party."
And why, moreover, was it unfolding outside where Connor could watch from a distance? That was real hard, that was. Connor was 10 months younger than the youngest child in his class at Bell Attached, the school that served the children of Bell College's professional community. He was nowhere near puberty, in a class where half the boys were shaving, at least occasionally.
"Connor, would it make you feel better if I told you that puberty turns boys into monsters?"
"Thank you for that little dose of sexism, Mother. Girls have trouble with puberty, too."
"But boys really do."
She could hardly believe that Maggie and Harley would allow Pauly to leave Connor out like this. "What's really wrong?" "All right, fine."
He got up, crossed the room, and went downstairs. She heard him shut the door to the basement that Dan had finished for him when he was 5. It was boy heaven down there with an Xbox and a TV-DVD combo and a hulking but powerful Dell computer, plus his dinosaur collection, all of them painted with the utmost realism, and his train set, HO grade, which had lighted houses, streetlights lining the streets, and lighted trains. He would play trains in the dark down there by the hour, muttering to himself in the voices of 100 train men and townsfolk, all of whom he had invented, all of whose lives evolved and changed over the years. Caitlin thought of the train set as a sort of ongoing novel, and that her boy was a word genius as much as he was a math genius. The care he lavished on everything he modeled came from his ability to concentrate. Even when he'd been little, he hadn't been clumsy. When he was 8, she'd discovered, while cleaning up one day, that the tiny human figures in his train set all had different colored eyes. They had been that carefully finished. She had loved him so then, looking down at a tiny suited figure with a tie so small that you had to look under a magnifying glass to see the design he'd painted on it. And then you would hear him deep in the night talking to himself, and you would realize that he was reciting a book he'd read, maybe even years ago, all from memory, just to enjoy it again. Connor and Dan had celebrated the completion of the room by putting a plaque on the door. The Connor Zone. She and her husband had celebrated in quite a different way later that night. This was your garden variety tract house, as isolated as it and its 3 neighbors were, and the walls were tract house thin. They did not feel that this extremely sensitive child needed to overhear the sounds of sex in the next room. And on that night at last, they'd been able to use their bed the way a bed was meant to be used, instead of being as still as possible, wincing at every squeak and keeping their cries to a whisper. "Dan," she said, walking into the kitchen where he'd begun trimming ribs, "there's something kind of ugly going on. Polly's having a party and Connor's not invited." "Jesus. They're actually outside playing with flashlights, which I kind of have the feeling is on purpose. Kids are cruel. Listen, incidentally, I had an email from Marcy Cotton about you."
"Oh?"
"They've reached the point of asking general faculty opinion."
"Oh, God.
I gave you a great report."
"What a relief.
Come on, what else would I do?"
"Tell the truth, like everybody else. I'm dull as dishwater in the classroom."
"No, you're actually interesting. It's physiological psychology that's dull. In the hands of most profs, it causes birds to die in the trees outside their classrooms. At least yours just fly off."
"Dull is dull. I should have used puppets or worn costumes."
"I would have preferred almost any other referee, frankly."
"Yeah, you and me both, but I can handle her. Maybe."
"Not too much."
Dan went to her, embraced her. "You're my girl." There came a sound from below, a crash.
"He just kicked the wall," Caitlin said. "Like father, like son.
Maybe a mano a mano would be good."
One of the most precious things about this Dan Callahan, whom her heart had whispered to her to marry, was that he was a genuinely good father. Not an easy thing to be for a boy as challenging as their son. But Connor's brilliance and demanding personality also made him fascinating, and she thought that the rewards for loving their boy were substantial. "Maybe a mano would be very good," she said. As he went downstairs, he noticed that the Connor Zone sign had been removed from the door, leaving some areas of peeled paint that would have to be repaired, but not right now. He started to open the door, thought better of it, and knocked. A moment of silence was followed by a grudging, "Okay." The room was dark and the trains were running. Connor loomed over the board like some kind of leering godlet, an image that Dan found oddly creepy. In fact, he found Connor in general oddly creepy. A great kid. He was crazy about him, but there was something sort of fundamentally creepy about somebody who was probably smarter than Shakespeare and certainly smarter than you. Way smarter.
"Hey there. I see you've abolished the Connor Zone."
"It's stupid." A streetcar, wonderfully modeled, shot around on the tracks, racing through intersections, wheeling out into the forest and then returning to the town. Passing Andy's garage and Sill's millinery and Carter's groceries, racing along as crossing guards whipped up and down and the figures inside sat as still as if frozen in terror.
"Isn't it going a little fast?"
I'm exceeding the speed limit and maybe they're all going to die.
It hurts, buddy. It's meant to. Only we need to get in front of it, figure out what we're doing wrong, and not do that anymore. That way we don't lose our friends.
Connor turned the transformer up a notch, and the streetcar shot off the tracks, tumbled through the woods, and crashed to the floor. The roof broke off and half the figures came out. Connor leaped around the table, grabbed the remains of the car, and smashed it to pieces against the tiles.
"Hey, hey, you're killing the floor here!"
Dan went down to him, but he was up again and off across the room.
"I've got to get rid of this whole kid's setup," he said, his voice cracking. "I'm an asshole, Dan. I'm a little boy. In fact, I'm the little boy."
Dan went over to the bed where Connor had thrown himself.
"Connor, your mom and I both felt you needed to skip grades. You were bored silly in third grade. You could do all the problems. You could read all the books."
"I can still do all the problems and read all the books. Only the difference now is I'm the class freak, Dan. The freak."
"You're not a freak. You just happen to be somewhat smarter than most people.
You know who I really relate to? I really relate to Junior Hamner. Do you know who that is?"
Dan thought that the Hamners had a little boy with Down syndrome. "He's that mentally disabled child, isn't he?"
"Exactly, another freak. We should be joined at the hip."
"Except that your mind, who knows what it might do one day? And Junior Hamner's always going to be 11 years old."
"Actually, he's 4, mental age."
"Okay, let's get down to it. What exactly happened to cause you to get ditched?"
"I told you, I'm a little boy. Little boys aren't allowed."
Dan had, to be honest, been one of the bullies. He'd had a childhood full of nightmares, so many and so intense, that he now speculated that he might have been an abuse victim. He'd often been taken night fishing by an old man who lived down the block. Most of the time his Uncle Frank had been with them, and Frank was, to this day, as straight an arrow as had ever been carved. But there had been times when he and Mr. Aymer had been out there alone all night, and he wondered what had transpired then. He remembered strange violence, screaming, being swarmed by flies. And maybe those were screen memories for things Mr. Aymer had done that should not have been done. Dan had been angry and big, so he used to push the little kids around, whip their butts, take their money, you name it. So he could understand the ugly frustrations of Paulie Warner and the other boys as well as he could his own boys' hurt. He put his arm around Connor's shoulders, gave him a friendly squeeze. This was not like this a week ago, 2 days ago.
"Let me tell you what they've done. They have created a club called the Connor Busters. Clever name, do you get it? Everybody in the 7th grade is supposed to be a Connor Buster, except me, of course."
He stopped, his voice cracking. Dan looked over to see the young face twisted in pain, agony.
"I'm sorry, Dan. Here I go, being a little boy.
Look, I was a class bully. I would have been a Connor Buster, for sure. But I cried, too. And you can be sure that Paulie Warner and the rest of them are just as vulnerable. You're a little behind them physically, Connor. But mentally, you're on another planet, in another universe."
"Aye. And there's the rub. So, listen, my friend, and you shall hear of the careful humiliation of Connor the Queer."
"You're not gay."
"I have no idea. I'm prepubescent."
"And incidentally, without hurting her, you have got to tell Mom to stop bragging about me to the other mothers." Now that was a stunner. Caitlin was hardly your braggart mama. That doesn't sound like her somehow.
"She refers to me as genius. My son is a genius," she says. "And do you know that Mrs. Warner resents this, and Mrs. Taylor and Mrs. Fisk and probably every other faculty wife with a kid at BA? Because they all want geniuses, Dan. This is a college. These are college people, and I really am a genius, and they resent me. So, you give a kid ammo like that, the parents can't stand some classmate with an unfortunate disability like mine, and that poor cripple is fair game."
Dan could certainly see from Connor's standpoint why he might view his intelligence as a deformity. It was ugly, though, to see him driven to feel that way about a gift so rare. The thing about Caitlin was, if you were going to love her and you were going to be her husband, you were going to have to accept that Connor was the center of the universe for her. He was, indeed, a professor's dream child, and she was, indeed, a professor. She's always bragged, Connor. She's really messing me up.
At that moment, flashlights began appearing in their yard, swarming over from the Warners. There were also voices making low howling sounds.
Great, Connor muttered as he turned out his bedside light.
For a few more seconds, Dan hoped that this was something nice, but when he heard them calling Connor's name, he knew that it was more cruelty, and he, perhaps unfortunately, got mad. He headed for the glass door that opened out onto the underdeck in the yard.
Dan, please just go upstairs.
Connor, those kids don't have any business in this yard.
Dan, please.
Dan opened the door. Behind him, Connor pulled his bedspread over his head. Then Dan heard cracking sounds. He realized that somebody was hitting the above-ground pool with what sounded like a board or even a hammer.
All right, that's enough, he shouted as he strode up to the shape that was hacking away at the pool.
It was a kid he didn't recognize, but when the boy saw him, he tried to run. Dan got him by the collar of his jacket. The kid swung and managed to land a crooked blow on Dan's thigh, and the rest of them didn't run. He heard Polly Warner say in an almost bored voice,
"Let him go, Dan."
Dan carried him across to the fence and dumped him over.
"Get out of here, all of you!"
He grabbed Polly as he was leaving.
"You ought to be ashamed of yourself."
Polly snorted laughter. Only a miracle from above prevented Dan from smacking him. Instead, he brushed past him and strode across the Warner's driveway.
"Get off my property!" Polly shouted from behind him.
He hammered on the front door. A couple of seconds later, Maggie opened it. He was so furious that for a moment he was at a loss for words, and the two of them just stared at each other. Finally, he spoke.
"Keep those vandals out of my yard, Maggie, or I'm calling the cops."
"Dan?" "Polly had his gang out there busting up our pool, dammit."
"It's not on, Maggie. If I have to, I'll see you guys in family court."
"Polly might not like Connor anymore, that's his privilege. But when he starts vandalizing our stuff, that I am not going to allow." She turned around, calling into the house,
"Polly?"
Then,
"Polly?"
He came, not looking afraid in the least, Dan noted. He was growing up, Polly Warner was. The peach fuzz was getting dark, the eyes getting hard.
"Did you bust up their pool?"
"No."
"Yeah, you did. Or your friend did. I think they have a little gang, Maggie."
"What's your little gang called, Polly?"
"I don't have a gang."
Maggie shoved his shoulder.
"Where's Connor, Polly?"
"He couldn't come."
"They cut him out, and the gang is called the Connor Busters, and they invaded our yard with the intention of vandalizing us, and I'm not going to stand for it, Maggie."
"Okay. Hey," Maggie called into the house. Boys began to appear, just young enough to be a bit wide-eyed with worry.
"Party's over, fellas. Call your parents and tell them to pick you up. You can wait on the front porch. I don't want you in here anymore. I've already had a shelf busted in my fridge."
"That was an accident, Mom."
"And now the neighbors are complaining, and I've had it. You go up to your room, young man."
Polly started to speak, but she cuffed him in the back of the head.
"Learn how to choose your friends, dummy," she said.
He went upstairs, his face red, fighting tears. As Dan left, the other boys filtered out behind him. They crowded together on the front porch, blowing on their hands and waiting for their rides. He walked across the yards, feeling the cold now through his cotton chinos and his light sweater. The kids sure were growing up, and it was sad. Last July, he supposed, had been the high summer of Connor's childhood. He remembered those days of his own life. He'd been like some kind of water creature, like all the kids who lived along the lakes of Madison. He went over to the pool. The moon was rising, and in its light he could see that the little creep had done a fair job on the fiberglass. As he was walking back to the house, something caught his eye. A flash, he thought, coming from somewhere to the west in the direction of the town. An explosion? There was no following rumble, so he supposed not. Nothing ever happened around here anyway, except for kid trouble. Kids were a problem in any college town. Bored, affluent, smart faculty brats were a notorious irritant on every campus he'd ever worked. He went in and gently explained to Connor what had happened.
"Son, there will be no fallout from this, you'll see. Monday morning in school, it'll be as if none of it ever happened."
I'm so glad. Count on it. They went a step too far, that's all. They're testing, trying to figure out who they want to be. And they're not like you. They're much simpler, to be honest. So even though they're older, in many ways they're less mature.
Dan, do you think you could find out about the Wilton Public Schools for me since I really can't return to BA?
I think the, middle school, what's it called, Colonel Saunders Memorial or something, has a rather good reputation in shop. And of course the football team is the stuff of local legend. Who knows, maybe I can try out for back end.
Dan saw that there was nothing to be gained by arguing with him. He'd go up and report to Caitlin.
As he left, Connor said, "Promise me, Dan, call Wilton."
"I'll call them first thing Monday.
And that boot camp in Lockridge, I could commute actually on the Louisville bus. I wouldn't have to live in the barracks or anything."
"Yeah, that's a possibility too."
Dan turned to leave, and to his surprise, saw a boy standing just beyond the deck. His shape was clearly visible in the moonlight. He was not one of the gangling creeps from Paulie's party. This kid looked even smaller than Connor, which was very strange because Connor himself was the youngest child on Oak Road, not counting six-month-old Jilly Jeffers. It was dark in the underdeck, but the child was in the light of the moon. Something struck Dan then, hit him, like an axe blow between the eyes. He was in a loud, echoing space, looking down through a round hole, and there was a surface far below, glistening silver, just like this, in moonlight, just like this. He felt in that moment a longing so powerful that it seemed to stop his blood, to cripple him with a sense of loss that might actually be larger than he could contain. For a moment he was disoriented, as if detached from the ground, and he fell forward. The next thing he knew, somebody was calling him, far away. "Dad! Oh my God! Mom! Mom!"
Then footsteps. Then he was aware that he'd fallen, and his head hurt. That was it. He'd hit his head on a beam. Caitlin and Connor were there. They were terrified. No problem. Had to calm them down.
"Oops," he croaked.
"Dan, don't move." He sat up.
"I about knocked myself silly."
"What happened, honey?"
"I was..."
He looked around the cold, dark space.
"I hit my head, one of the beams. I thought those kids had come back."
"What kids?"
"Paulie and his buddies."
"What were they doing in our yard?"
"It's a long story, Mom. And there was somebody out there just now," he pointed. "Something, anyway. It was an owl right over there, a barn owl standing beside the pool."
There was nothing in the backyard now except the pool itself, gray in the moonlight. And beyond it, the strip of woods that separated all the houses from a cornfield that fronted on Wilton Road. Nothing more was said about the incident. Caitlin spent some time then with her son. She already knew all that had happened. Maggie had called, full of apologies. The boys had overstepped. Paulie would resume the old friendship. She would make sure of that. She left him listening to a Leonard Cohen CD, another of his private eccentricities. God forbid that any of the other children should ever find those CDs, or his audiobooks of things like James Joyce's fantastically obscure and prolix Finnegan's Wake, from which he drew some sort of equally obscure comfort. Maybe he even understood it. Who could know? She took a bottle of wine and a couple of glasses up to their bedroom and drank some wine with her husband. No more Connor until the morning. They lay together then with the light of the westering moon falling on their naked bodies and the wine in them. Dan said, "You want to give it a try?"
"With no diaphragm?"
"Clean and clear." She kissed him.
"I do, I do."
"Oh, wow, hey." He reached over, got his wine glass and raised it. "To the next genius, Callahan, if we make it."
"Okay, listen, you, I do want to, but... this is not the right moment, Dan, and you know that."
"The tenure will come."
"The tenure may come, and when it does, we celebrate."
She laughed a little. "By doing this incredibly profound thing of making another child. But Dan, if you do not get it, then..."
"The tenure will come.
Marcy is a complex, difficult human being." He threw himself back on the bed. She laid a hand on his head.
"You sure you're okay, Dan?"
"Absolutely."
"Well,
You know there's no beam down there you could have hit your head on, so that's not what happened. He knew it. He allowed himself to consider the possibility of a seizure. He'd had them as a child. He remembered them. They would start with an aura that involved seeing his planetarium lights, then progress to this bizarre, echoing room where there would be unspeakable things. Human bodies with no skin, giant flies. And then it would be morning and he'd wake up perfectly fine. He had never told a soul about the seizures, and he didn't intend to tell Caitlin now. They were perhaps one of the reasons that he had become a physiological psychologist. His own suffering had led him to a fascination with the mechanics and abnormalities of the brain. They slept then, joined to the sleeping world of man, a place that is different by night, that is not at all what it seems. They did not sleep alone, though. They were watched and carefully watched. Minds very different from our own, with objectives and needs completely beyond the imagining of the Callahans, drew conclusions about what they saw and acted on those conclusions. Deep in the night they acted, and Marcy Cotton became the latest victim of the great and intricate terror. And then things went wrong. Very, very wrong. 4. Oak Road was so quiet at 3 a.m. that you could hear the whispering fall of individual pine needles as they dropped in the woods that separated the houses from the farmer's field behind them. So when screams erupted, every human being and all the animals woke up instantly. Marcy Cotton also heard the cries, and an expressionless voice repeating again and again, "What can we do to help you stop screaming?" Only when she felt herself suck breath and realized that the narrow black cot from which she could not rise was not her bed, did she connect with the fact that the screaming was coming from her. She thought, nightmare. And then she screamed again. There were 4 families living at the end of Oak Road, all Bell College faculty. The last house on the dead end was occupied by the Jeffers, Nancy and Chris and their baby daughter. Beside them were the Callahans, next the Warners, Harley and Maggie, Polly and Amy. The house closest to the beginning of Oak Road belonged to the Keltons, 2 parents and 2 teenage sons. At the Kelton house, Manrico, the family dog, sat up and snorted, then stood and commenced barking. The 2 teenagers leaped out of bed and started pulling on their pants. Nancy Jeffers also screamed, and Chris, the youthful head of the physics department, jumped up as if there was a snake in the bed. Out the bedroom window he saw a glow through the woods. "Dear God, there's a fire," he shouted, pulling on a pair of rubber overshoes and an overcoat. The triad had been commanded to bring Marcy Cotton to Dan Callahan. The collective wanted them to bond her to him, so that she would do anything to make sure his tenure bid succeeded. There must be no chance that the Callahans would leave Wilton, where every street, alley, basement, attic, and mind was known to the collective. An attack on the Callahans was inevitable, and the collective's plan to defend them had been constructed around their staying in the town. Important work, certainly, but not all that they intended to do on this night. There was a reason this particular triad called themselves the 3 Thieves, which was their imperfect ability to handle temptation. And Marcy was such very strong temptation. Polly Warner ran into his parents' room, shouting that the Kelton's house was on fire. Harley Warner said to his wife, "My God, they might be trapped." Maggie went to the window. "Is that a fire? It's very steady." "Somebody's really screaming," Amy said, coming in behind her brother. "Let's go over there," Polly said. Harley was pulling on his jeans. "Not you kids." "Oh, Dad, Polly." "Not until I know what's going on out there." He did not want his children exposed to whatever might be happening over there, not given the agony he was hearing in those screams.